right now, I think the path forward is probably we got to figure out how to have either more incentives or a way to carve back a lot of the effectively the soft cost side of the development pro forma, because otherwise, like, this stuff's not going to get built.
Welcome to Toronto Under Construction, a podcast about everything Toronto real estate.
Welcome to Toronto Under Construction, a podcast about everything Toronto real estate. My name is Ben Myers, and for folks that don't know me, I run a boutique residential real estate advisory firm in, as you might guess it, Toronto. We have a special guest host today, Robert Barrion. I screwed your name up. Of BCGI Barrion Consulting Group, an executive search firm dedicated to the real estate industry. I'm getting so good at reading your bio, but I screwed it up the one time you're here. So, Robert, welcome to the show. And instead of me reading the sponsor read, tell us what your company does.
Sure. Thank you. And since I'm here, you can't stop me. So the extended dance mix version is I started in brokerage at CBRE and then in investment banking at CIBC Wood Gundy. And then when there was a real estate recession, I thought I was getting out of the real estate industry because Fortune magazine told me there'd never be another building built in my lifetime. So joke's on me. I went into the search business covering real estate companies. My clients are typically developers, commercial or residential, or investors, private equity, pension funds or REITs, or lenders, either bank or alternative lenders. And what it really means is all I do all day is gossip about the real estate industry with, candidates and with clients. And as long as I keep the secrets, I stay out of the witness protection program, which is my main objective.
Your main objective. Perfect. Perfect. Well, one of your clients is here today, and our guest is the Chief Investment Officer at Kingset Capital. He joined in 2008 and leads Kingset's investments team, which sources, underwrites, and structures investment transactions for Kingset's various fund strategies. Prior to joining Kingset Capital, Colin held senior roles at BMO Capital Markets and Royal LePage Advisors, where he obtained a broad range of investment experience in all asset classes of real estate throughout North America. Colin holds a Bachelor of Science degree in economics from the University of Victoria. Welcome to the show, Colin Barrion.
Did I say that right?
Yeah, you did. Thank you, Ben. Good intro.
Thank you. Well, we're just going to jump in. We're just going to hit you with a bunch of questions, and we'll go from there. We'll start out real softball question here. I'm an economics grad myself. What led you to pursue that degree?
Well, I started pursuing a degree in engineering. Actually, it had nothing to do with economics. And in my second year, I realized that I enjoyed my economics elective a lot better than I did my engineering degree.
Interesting.
the focus at University of Victoria and the economics program, they have a Bachelor of Science, Math, and Economics program, which is a little bit unique. And I had an opportunity to switch over to that. And there you go. And now I have an economics degree. Way more fun than engineering. And obviously, led me to this opportunity eventually. So grateful for that.
It is called the dismal science, though. It's not that much fun.
What are you talking about? It was great. No. It was totally good.
So, like me, you started off in the brokerage business.
Yes.
I often tell people that's a good place to start. Do you share that view for someone coming into the industry?
Yeah, I started actually in consulting advisory, in an advisory practice at Royal LePage. And then from there, we ended up underwriting a lot of the brokerage deals for Royal LePage Commercial. At the time, it was Trevor Blakely, Jamie Ziegel was leading the group. And so, it was a combination of starting in the advisory and consulting business where you're learning due diligence, you're reading leases, you're rolling up your sleeves on all sorts of different types of transactions. You're doing a little bit of consulting work, a little bit of planning work for the city. At the time, the team was led by Scott Chandler, who's still in the business today, and Tony Reale. My role sort of, went from there to more on the brokerage side as I started to work more with Trevor Blakely and Keith Jamieson back in those days. This had been in, the early 2000s.
right. And then so you were you looking to change jobs? Like what was the kind of impetus to going into investment banking?
I mean, Robert might know this story better than me because he was actually the architect of it.
Wow.
Which is ironic that now we're here. We are doing a podcast many years later. But at the time, what was happening was Bank of Montreal was looking to expand a real estate practice, a real estate investment banking practice. They didn't have one before. I think they reached out to you, Robert, to do that. Mm-hmm. And Robert, through his connections, managed to form the team that was in 2005 the real estate investment banking group for Bank of Montreal, and I was a lowly analyst making my way over there.
What's that? A chattel.
That's right. A chattel, not a fixture. And so I ended up going, en masse with a number of people.
Oh, okay.
So it was a little bit of a different route into investment banking. It wasn't, like I was pursuing an investment banking role. Okay. Probably too naive at the time to realize what that meant and what that entailed, but, was convinced it was the right thing to do. And so went over in 2005, very different experience, investment banking. And in those days was a very different experience. I think today it's probably, a little bit more better lifetime management, in terms of work-life balance than it was back in those days. But the benefit of working in investment bank is obviously to be able to get access to and learn all about that business space, capital markets, financing, all those great things is hugely beneficial. So joined in 2005 and had a very intensive, effectively 3 years in investment banking.
Huh. I recall when I was in investment banking, you stayed till 11 o'clock just in case something happened. At least now you get to leave at 6. And if something happens, you can log in from home and work all night instead of having to go back downtown and work all night.
Right. So, the hours were, it's 7 days a week. And the only day that you didn't work 8 hours was on Sunday. You worked 7 hours.
But that was that was casual day.
That was casual day, that's right. God. Different era now.
Wow. Yeah. And so what brought about the move to Kingsa? How did that come about?
Yeah, that came about also in sort of an indirect way. I had while I was at BMO, I got my real estate license. So I was doing a lot more direct brokerage, selling, supporting clients. And so there was a property that Kingset was selling at the time, 2233 Shepherd Industrial Building on Highway 400. And I was tasked with doing the tours and, marketing the asset. And that was the first time I had met Peter Agar in person and a few other people from Kingset. Kingset, hadn't been around that long at that point in time, founded in 2002. And they were, a relatively small shop looking to grow. And my interaction with them through that transaction is really what precipitated an offer from them for me to come and join them. So again, totally indirect.
Yeah.
And then I joined Kingset in 2008 and have been there ever since.
Wow.
Yeah.
So, Kingset has, different, pockets of money, in funds, series. And, but since this podcast focuses on residential, what buckets of capital do you have that, that work towards the residential housing business?
Almost every one of our buckets of capital probably touches the residential business in some manner. Our largest pool of capital, our growth fund, which we raised $2 billion of equity 2 summers ago, and are deploying that over the course of the next the last 2 years and the 2 years going forward, has in the past participated in condo residential development projects, done lots of entitled land for residential development projects, was really the birthplace of a lot of the residential ideas that we currently have, as that's always been our largest pool of capital and our most, we started the company on that business.
And this is it's equity.
And it's equity, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So, and then out of that came, our urban infill fund concept, which raised just shy of $800 million in 2 funds. And that was really a land assembly fund. We did for the better part of a decade, look for opportunities to assemble land along Yonge Street, anywhere sort of in major markets and well-located, you know, that are effectively condo sites today. We did our first condo project was Aura at Yonge and Gerrard with Canderel. That was back in 2008, so right around the time of the global financial crisis.
You didn't go for anything small off the top, eh?
That was, it's a great point. It was a massive project. And at the time, it was hard for developers to get financing, to get construction financing, despite, you know, it being pre-sold. And but the condo market was still sort of at its birth, you know, to infancy to where it is today. And so we started with that. And then we also have a number of other funds that we spun out of our growth fund, our residential development fund, which is solely focused on developing condos. And so that is effectively the same types of returns that the growth fund targets. But given that condo projects, you know, obviously take some time to develop and your IRR kind of comes down a little bit because you don't have cash flow supporting the investment along the way, we recognize that generally the returns are dilutive to our growth fund returns, despite the fact that we would still be making, you know, 2x cash flow multiples and decent returns. And so we raised a dedicated pool of capital today. They're all still very active, and we continue to find opportunities in this market, you know, for the residential development fund, structured differently than they were before. But yeah. Anyway, lots going on in the residential development space. Let me put it that way.
That's a good.
Yeah. Sorry. And the rental, like you've got, Two St. Thomas and, you know,
that's in our core fund. Yeah.
So those are ongoing assets that you run as rentals.
That's right. Yeah. Our core fund owns about 4,000 units of residential rental, both purpose-built, newer construction and more older stock, which we acquired out of the Northview transaction a couple years ago with Starlight. Yeah, so that's a long-term open-end fund that has a significant investment in residential real estate. And then also we have an affordable housing fund, which is very active today with all of the programs going on for affordable housing development. We're taking, you know, we have access to all of the same programs, and we're coming out of the ground with a project that I can go into more detail about, you know, when you want to get into it. Perfect. So lots going on.
Yeah.
Lots going on. it's interesting. Everyone always thinks we're commercial, and we are commercial. I mean, there are lots of asset classes, but obviously residential plays a pretty big part of our business.
Yeah. So I guess, you know, we can fast forward to today's market. You've got obviously still a lot of capital to deploy in some of these funds. How has your, you know, underwriting process changed given the, you know, kind of macroeconomic shift that we're looking at right now? Is some of it the same, or is it changed for different asset classes?
For sure changed. I don't know anybody who would say that they're doing these things exactly the same way they were doing a couple years ago. We're responding to the market. I think that's the best way to describe it. There's a need for capital for residential development, condo development. I think we have, a bit of a luxury today to find the right project with the right risk mitigants. You know, before, if you were going to go down the route of investing in a condo project, you would find a site that was either zoned or not zoned, take it through the entitlement process, pre-sell it, then capitalize it, you know, from an equity perspective and a debt perspective, take it through construction and close. And that whole time frame would take, you know, for most of the towers in Toronto, probably 7 years or 5 years or, you know, however long it would take. And today, you know, with interest rates where they are, you don't have the luxury of time. Like, that worked fine when financing was free and it didn't, and carry costs didn't really exist. And today it's all about speed. So, you know, what are the projects that we're finding today? I mean, you can skip the whole pre-development process effectively. You can find projects today that are substantially pre-sold at numbers that aren't, you know, sky high and, you know, arguably possibly above market. You can find projects where shovel's about to go on the ground. The developer, you know, it's actually not dissimilar to 2008, where the developers are having a little bit of trouble getting financing because the banks are putting, you know, more stringent rules and underwriting on the financing for condo projects today as they're reading headlines and, you know, seeing all the same stuff that you're seeing. So you can come in, step in with a large balance sheet, help structure the debt, get access to it, and help structure it. And then you know, enter projects that are effectively shovel ready so that your sales risk is mitigated because it's largely pre-sold. Your construction risk is mitigated because it's largely fixed at the point when you're getting construction financing, and then you get construction financing. So if anything, I find today, you know, we get to find some really excellent opportunities in the residential space. You just have to look for them and then structure them right.
Yeah.
And they're nice compressed timeframes, which, you know, make the returns look good.
Yeah. Will you participate both in the debt and the equity of the same project?
Typically, we don't. Typically, you know, if we're the equity in a project, you know, we're using effectively bank financing.
Yeah.
We do have a mortgage business that participates in financing projects. They're probably underwriting, when I say, you know, we're underwriting things stringently or differently, in the sense that we're trying to shorten the time frame and find opportunities where we can reduce that risk through the time frame and through things like fixed price contracts or pre-sales. You know, our mortgage business and their underwriters are looking at it with, you know, a very conservative loan to value or a very, you know, conservative loan to cost, different types of collateral. I mean, they have a lending hat on, I have an equity hat on. So they look at financing projects. I look for placing equity in our various investor equity funds.
Yeah. Have you looked at any projects where the developer's looking to convert condo to rental?
Yes, lots of those. There are no shortage of those today. I would say that hits my desk, you know, at least twice a week across the country. Well, mainly Toronto and Vancouver and some Montreal to a lesser extent, but lots. I mean, basically, the developer today is faced with the same headwinds, sitting on land. Pre-sale market's not there, needs to do something. There are good programs out there, MLI Select, the RCFI program, which has been renamed, but effectively the same thing. You know, if you can have more of a zero carbon angle or you add some affordable housing to your rental mix, you can get some good financing. So that's, you know, that's a great CMHC program by the government. I applaud it. We use it. I think it works really well. And, you know, with those types of programs, you can sort of make that pivot to develop out rental, but you're still faced with, you know, two large big variables that you have to be uncertain about. One, rents. What are my rent going to be in, you know, when I build it, when I go and lease it? And two, what's my exit cap rate? You know, if you're a long-term holder, you probably don't mind as much, but if you're a condo developer and you're probably building it and thinking, you know, I'd like to capitalize this asset, move on to the next one.
Yeah.
You know, exit cap rate has a pretty big impact. So I look at that as, while the rental market is very strong, has very low vacancy across the country, and so it shouldn't be a problem to lease up the building. You know, those two variables are pretty big variables. What's my rent? What's my cap rate? And, you know, that's a lot of uncertainty to me. So we're only looking at purpose-built rental in our world if we think it's the right thing to do for our long-term core fund. And we do own some pieces of land that we quite like, Yorkville, where, you know, if you built a rental tower in Yorkville, I got to think that's probably a pretty good location, that rent growth profile. And I'd be pretty excited to own that long-term. And so outside of that, it's not, you know, a strategy that's sort of top of the list for us in terms of deploying capital.
So you like the exit strategy in the condo projects. You like to have a fixed
exit. I love having it pre-sold. I mean, it's like basically having, or if you can find a rental project with a pre-buy, you know, but those are typically hard to find too.
Yeah.
If you're, you know, since you have the vantage point on, you know, condos as well as rentals, you know, I remember when clients started building purpose-built rental again, you know, coming into the market, the term that was used was condo quality, which I think meant like, you know, granite countertops and stainless steel appliances at the time. But I think of this, you know, if you're going to own something for 20 years, you care about the elevator, you know, over a 20-year lifetime. If you're a condo developer, you know, you get past Tarion, you know, then it's somebody else's problem.
Right.
You know, if you're building a rental for your own portfolio, is it higher quality than a condo?
Well, I think some condo developers might, listening in on this, might say, well, I would never build a condo project that I need to worry about the elevator 10 years from now. But I think, you know, condo quality versus rent building rental has, to me, a slightly different meaning. I mean, just going past even the construction quality, because you're right, you want to think about building systems in your investment that are sustainable and you're not going to have, you know, problems down the road. I think for the most part, condo builders who are building a business on their reputation are probably also thinking about those things, because it's, you know, they've been at it for a long time. They probably will be at it for a long time, and it's going to be hard for them to pre-sell something in the future that didn't turn out so well for its investors.
And a lot of investor buyers are buying multiple projects too.
And they use social media a lot, so you know you have to be careful with what you say. So I applaud the developers who do a good job of that. I think it's a great question, because I think rental versus condo has different ideas and concepts from a long-term planning perspective. Things like, you know, when people buy a condo off a plan, and it might be an investor, you know, you might fit a bed into some of these bedrooms, but not a dresser, as an example. Or you might have a living room and the TV is, you know, 3 feet from your face, or, you know, there's in some instances, maybe the layout's not great. You can't do that in rental, right? Because then you can't rent it.
Right. So even if you rent it once, you know, you're going to have to rent it again.
Right,
you know,
right.
Or
next thing you know, you got to charge less rent because you can't rent it. So I think there's things that you do in the design that are hugely important. And we have, in projects that we've built, many times built a replica of the room using styrofoam and stud, you know, whatever, metal studs, and basically so that you can walk around. We'll stick styrofoam pieces of furniture in it so you can see if you fit a king size bed in this room, for example, do you get one end table or two end tables? Can you fit another armoire? Can you stick a desk in the corner? How does somebody work in here? How does it feel when you walk around the island and then you go sit on the couch? You know, like things like that. That I think is the bigger issue when you're building rental for the long term, is like you want to make sure that 5 years from now, when the experiment is unfolding and you're renting the space, you'll know pretty quick if you can't grow your rents, or you've got a type of unit that you can't lease, or there's a type of amenity that everybody wants that you didn't bother researching or building. So I think that's probably more the long-term issue when you're building rental.
Interesting. Yeah, I mean, we've talked about it on the show plenty of times. You know, you have to resell that unit, and there's going to be a lot of condo projects with 375 square foot units, studios, and 455 square foot one bedrooms. And I think for the long term, it's just not even a good solution for someone that wants to live in a one bedroom, right? It's just a very small unit. So it is interesting how my recommendations change between rentals and condos.
For sure. And units are getting smaller. And I think, you know, those that are building, that are successful at building the smaller units for rental, for long-term rental, are getting very creative in how they can use the space. Lots of modular, you know, furniture and walls and all sorts of things that you can do to get the most out of the space, be able to charge the client or, you know, the tenant what looks like, you know, a lower chunk rent, but has a high price per foot on it that the developer can then build the project, keep it leased, and, you know, make the returns work. That's always the challenge.
I had a question for you, and I'm not sure if this is something that you guys discuss. I'm sure it is. Are you trying to diversify within each fund to limit the correlations between the deals? And do you do that? If you do it by geography, type, client, timeline, you know, how do you try to do it so that you're not, you know, putting your capital at risk?
Every fund's different. Our core fund, you know, we pay a lot of attention to diversity by asset class, geography. It's more of a long-term core strategy. If you have, you know, sort of a balanced approach to investing and you're exposed in any one asset class or market, you would expect to have less volatility. That's the thesis anyway. That said, the core fund, even the core fund has, you know, most of its investment is in Toronto. Toronto is the largest city in Canada and has, I think, you know, great economic driver tailwinds. And so we continue to find opportunities in this market for our core fund. Also helps that we, you know, it's our head office. We work, we breathe and live in this city. So feel like we have probably the best understanding of it out of all the other asset classes. The other asset classes, I mean, do we have the same level of diversity? Probably not, or you know, mix. The value add fund is really focused on returns, so not so much. The asset classes that come about through the value add fund are probably more cyclical in nature. And so, you know, its focus today would probably be more on retail, office, you know, things that have fallen out of favor to some extent. The last fund, where, you know, was seeded with a lot of residential, industrial, more because that was the opportunity that was presented at the time.
Yeah.
And, you know, coming out of that, you know, we'll do very well as a result. But it wasn't as though we said, you know what, we need to find, you know, a certain mix of assets. It was those are the opportunities that were presented and worked. The returns worked for the value add fund. You know, our residential development fund, we usually like to try and have a mix of Toronto and Vancouver, so you're not exposed to one market. Mm-hmm. Hasn't invested outside of those two markets because those are really the only condo markets in Canada, Montreal, you know, to a lesser extent. But you know, it's been pretty quiet there on the condo side, and there really hasn't been, you know, outside of that the returns that we can sort of make sense of. And then the rest of the funds are affordable housing fund. You know, it's for the most part focused on Toronto, building affordable housing in Toronto, and the balance of the funds aren't really focused on
from a developer diversity. Perspective that you're providing equity to, will you take chances on a first time guy or someone that's done a couple small projects or?
Yeah, sure.
Yeah.
Track record is important. And so even a first time person that has done something you can go look at and see how they were able to, you know, deploy their skill set or, you know, execute whatever the strategy was that they did. And our mortgage business is a great place as well to offer a form of equity or a type of equity investment. I mean, effectively it's mezz lending. So it's like preferred equity investment, so to speak, with a different security package. But that's a nice way to sort of allow somebody to get capitalized into a new idea. Maybe it's a new entrant into the market. Maybe they have a great idea, just don't have the capital. And so that's a nice place to go to be able to get equity-like financing for new entrants into whatever the space is or the market is. And we look at all asset classes in that vehicle too. You know, our preference when we do an equity joint venture would be no problem if you have an idea and, you know, you're building a track record. But our preference would be to, you know, find that group that you can do the first one and then the next one and then the next one and the next one and the next one. And you're building a pipeline of deals together. And so sometimes those work great, other times, you know, not so much. And so the track record does help a little bit in terms of if you're trying to find that long-term partner, you get a little bit better look back to see, you know, what their expertise is.
Yeah.
But certainly open-minded, put it that way.
And how active are you in once you've provided the capital to this developer in providing any expertise on unit mix, pricing, launch strategy? Are you just letting them do their thing? Or are you trying to be active in managing your investment?
I think it's a balance. I think it's a mix. So our partner is our managing partner. And right out of our limited partnership language, it'll say, you know, you're the managing partner and you're making suggestions for KingSett and providing recommendations for approval from the partnerships. We have in all of our joint ventures unanimous decision making. So it doesn't matter if we're an 80% partner and they're a 20% partner, there's still a 50-50 decision making process. That's good alignment.
Yeah.
And we have a level of expertise. We have probably more input or regular meetings or reporting that, you know, all works pretty fluidly with the partner. But it is a partnership. We're throwing out ideas, they're throwing out ideas, they're executing the ideas. They're getting paid, you know, fees or whatever types of incentives or profit participation or things that you're using to incentivize your partner to help perform. And it's like a collaborative process. And so I think that's the same way we would approach any partnership, whether it's, you know, with a large partner like RioCan or, you know, somebody who's just starting out.
Interesting.
Yeah,
I mean, one of the, you know, things that, you know, I observe is that all of the new projects, whether they're condo or rental, it seems like the price problem is solved by shrinking the unit size, which is fine. You know, there's a time in your life when you can live in 400 square feet or 350 square feet or 325 square feet. You know, but if you meet somebody else who also lives in that, then you get a third person between you, you know, you need more space. Mm-hmm. If the condo sold once, so it's, you know, it's gone. I wonder, with your rental portfolio, is there ever any discussion about having, you know, a flexibility between units? I don't know, like a knockout panel or something, so you can say this three unit, two bedroom could become a three, because you know, looking at our experience in New York was that in New York, you could buy three small units and put them together and double your money. I feel like in Toronto right now, you could actually buy a big unit, and if you could divide it up, you'd double your money.
Right.
But if you're going to own it for the long term, same as the elevator, you know, you need to worry about maximizing in the long term.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it would require, you know, if you had the two, you know, studios or 2 1-bedrooms side by side and you wanted to convert them, you know, and end up with one kitchen or, you know, and then multiple bedrooms, you know, it obviously would require a little bit of planning. Punch out panel is an easy way to sort of do it. We have looked at it. We've done, you know, some rough ideas and sketches where, you know, or for example, there are, you know, in some instances, 2 bedroom or 3 bedrooms have a hard time renting, and but, you know, studios or 1 bedrooms may not. And so could you go the other way, remove the knockout panel, maybe you plumbed in the kitchen and an extra bathroom, or maybe you don't need an extra bathroom or whatever. And basically then you can go the other route. So you have that flexibility. I think probably the impediment to that is because the margins are already so thin on the development to begin with, that anytime you try to incorporate some additional planning into the design, it just costs more.
Right.
And so, you know, those types of things where you're trying to look through the plans and the costs and the pro forma where you can, you know, shave off in order to make it work. And today, more than ever, it's hard to make it work.
Right.
And so I think those probably get kind of moved to the side.
I feel like that's
a good suggestion.
I feel like that, you know, could be a city thing rather than the city making you do these 3-bedroom condo units that nobody wants to buy. The city could say, all right, put the knockout panels in, and at least someone down the road 15 years from now will be able to have that option. Whereas once you've poured the concrete, you know, it's there. It's not, nobody's going to put the units together. I mean, I happen to live in a 40-year-old condo that's 3,400 feet, but that was, you know, the idea was move from the Kingsway, bring your dining room suite. That's not the way they're selling them now.
Right, right. That's right. Yeah. And it's, you know, it's a good suggestion. I think if you poll the development community, they'll probably say less controls and input from the municipality would be more helpful because our planning process is already too long and there's too many things that you're trying to sort of satisfy, and it's adding cost and time to an otherwise already constrained.
It would also be difficult if you had 3 studios rented and someone said they wanted a 3-bedroom and you say, well, we've got knockout panels in these units, but those 2 other people already living in that unit three of them come up for occupancy at the same time, right?
Well, so, there's that. There's also, you know, like if you, every time you do it, you got to spend the cost. And so you're probably looking at the capital return on that cost and things. But like, it is a good suggestion. Like having flexibility in a building is a great idea and does make sense. And I think for the long term, you know, there's lots of cities around the world that have a mix of, you know, proper livable spaces for families, you know, in Europe or Spain or, you know, we have migrated toward, you know, just smaller and smaller and, you know, high towers and, you know, a function of it's what you can, you know, afford to build because that's how the returns you work. And it is a constrained return and a compressed, you know, return that you're working with. Margins are super thin in development, especially for the risk you're taking on. And we've, you know, if there was ever a time to learn that, it was over the last 2 years. I mean, for a very long time, people had been, I think, overlooking the risk that went along with development because
there's no risk in development
because interest rates were like zero, and now here we are. And so, you know, you should get paid for the risk. And I think, you know, for some time you haven't been in that space. And so all these things I think are great ideas. Right now, I think the path forward is probably we got to figure out how to have either more incentives or a way to carve back a lot of effectively the soft cost side of the development pro forma, because otherwise, like, this stuff's not going to get built.
Yeah. Like, I mean, that's the biggest challenge. When people ask me why do families not live in condos? And I know, Robert, you've lived in a condo before. I just say, if we were to deliver a 1,000-square-foot condo downtown Toronto at $1,200 a foot, that's $1.2 million before you get into parking or condo fees.
Right.
You know, my neighborhood, you could buy an 1,800-square-foot townhome, with two parking spaces for $1.2 million. I have a little bit of a backyard, got more kids in the neighborhood, can walk to school. So it's like, when you look at the value, it just doesn't make sense that someone would live downtown unless they really, really love that neighborhood and wanted to be close to a specific school. Daycares are more expensive. Just everything is more expensive to live downtown than it is to even, like, this is one GO train stop away,
right?
So 11 minutes. So it just, you know, the
I mean, that's
the
good.
Value most, just doesn't make sense.
Most of the reasons people live downtown is because of traffic, right? Traffic and commute time. Yeah. And you know, are willing to sacrifice what you just described as a nice home living environment. But there are those that are willing to forego that because the commute is just so bad.
Yeah.
And then there's all sorts of reasons why somebody would prefer to live in a condo versus have a backyard and grass to cut and pretend to guess as to why, you know, somebody might want that. But, you know, I do agree that there are a lot of condos, designs, things that might, you know, not be particularly great to live in. Some developers have done it right. Others, you know, it's tricky, right? It's hard to make, again, to make the pro forma work. And so I think developers are doing what they can to try and get to the finish line, get to something that they can build and generate, quite frankly, not a great return on at the end of the day.
Yeah.
It's tough. It's a challenge.
Most, you know, equity investors, you know, look at the rise in interest rates as, well, it's either a negative because it affects their current portfolio value, or maybe it's a positive because they can buy distressed deals, you know, on the equity side. Since you're also in the lending business, is the, you know, the capital constraints, does that make it a net positive that interest rates have gone up, that you've got more opportunity to, you know, to buy? I know my clients last year, everybody wanted to hire somebody who was good at borrowing money, because, you know, apparently it got harder. So is rising interest rates, is that a net positive to you overall?
I think that these shocks to our system, or these instances where there's crisis or an imbalance, a capital imbalance, always breed an opportunity. I think what we do particularly well is find the opportunity. It so happens that right now the opportunity is more on the lending space. It's a function of banks pulling back, all sorts of lending sources pulling back, alternative lending sources pulling back, equities on the sidelines. People are looking to capitalize things, need some form of capital. And so, you know, both our senior mortgage business and our mezz fund business is very active. There was a change in the system. It was interest rates rapidly rising that created a dislocation. And now here we are, we have an imbalance and it breeds an opportunity. That's one opportunity. I would have thought there would have been more distress on the commercial real estate side. Canada continues to be a pretty resilient market where many of the investors don't use a lot of leverage. The assets are held in institutional hands. They're not particularly motivated vendors. You know, what you see in the U.S. from both an investment side and an operations side. I mean, just the office market in the U.S. and the way that office is leasing compared to, you know, how stable it is in our markets in Canada. It's just, it's such a different story. I would have thought we would probably have seen more distress, but in the commercial space, the bid-ask gap still remains pretty wide. And I'd say residential is really feeling it the most, mainly the development side. And that's really a function of both, you know, the sales price points have come off and capital's constrained, both debt and equity. So, you know, there is definitely a pause going on, right, in the condo market and in the housing market, really across all high rise and low rise in the housing market. We still have lots of immigration. We still have lots of, you know, tailwinds. And I think probably see coming out of this demand, suddenly it'll feel like there's like demand that's been sitting there trying to find homes. There's been none that have been built now for a number of years. And you could see a quick whiplash back to a housing market that becomes pretty robust again. So I think interest rates going, you know, like really rising, and it, you know, was the catalyst for a number of asset classes, a number of things, I think, to that have hit the real estate market, all aspects of it. And you do your best to find the opportunities in that. back to your original question, do I think there's more opportunities or less opportunities? I feel like it's probably the same amount of opportunities, just different.
Interesting. Yeah, we were talking on one of the last podcasts about there was a real decline in new condo sales in the second half of 2012 and really all of 2013. And then fast forward to 2017, the massive lack of supply due to that dearth of sales in that period led to, you know, almost a bubble in 2017.
That's right.
So we're almost looking at the exact same kind of timeline 10 years later, you know, a lack of sales in 2023 and obviously into 2024, Q1 2024 numbers came out. So it was the worst since 2009.
Right.
So we're really looking at, you know, 2027 as a potential for just a massive undersupply and prices going up. So really the question was, is in your war room, like what are you guys talking about in terms of when you anticipate the market, you know, coming back again? Are you having those conversations and how do you think you can take advantage of that? Is it buying lower priced land now for development in 4 years? You know, any insights you can provide on that kind of the back room discussions in the Kingset office?
Well, everybody loves to talk about when the overnight rate is coming down. Seems to be the number one topic of conversation if you ask anybody. And it's become so prolific in our industry that people now are saying, like, when are interest rates coming down? Everyone likes to talk about interest rates coming down.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, you've got a high short end of the curve and a very low long end of the curve. And I'd say that the residential market and the construction market is totally focused on the short end of the curve because construction financing is floating. People are buying homes over the prime rate. Many are doing variable even to this day, even though I think they're crazy. And, you know, like the residential market is exposed to the short end of the curve. So when does the short end come down? I mean, that to me is the big catalyst for what you're describing in terms of that demand actually getting back into the market.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's clear that financing has a big impact on people's affordability on housing. So everyone loves to talk and theorize about when the interest rate cut is coming.
Yeah.
Is that June? Is that now going to be July or August? You know, you can watch all sorts of stats and things on Bloomberg about, you know, when everybody thinks that's going to be. I mean, nobody can know. I will say consistently, monetary policy, when it comes to inflation, doesn't have the best track record going back forever in Canada. And so who knows where we'll actually end up when it's all said and done.
Mm-hmm.
There has been a tendency to overcorrect. And so because I don't know when that interest rate drop is coming or when that demand comes back in, you certainly can't make an investment decision on that basis. Like you can't buy something and say, I'm buying it because I know the interest rates are going to drop in August or September or October. You know, like, that's sort of the wrong thesis to make. It's certainly not a good way to invest capital. Then you set that aside, and the backdrop on the commercial side, actually commercial real estate is all focused on the long end of the curve because I'm leasing to tenants for long terms, and I'm trying to also finance a long term and match my, you know, liabilities with my assets and my balance sheet so that when my leases roll and I pick up an increase, then I can go get refinancing. Maybe I can finance out some capital. I mean, that's the long-term commercial investing thesis. That's why you go long, you know, both from your revenue side and your debt side. And that is interesting because what you're seeing today, and this is what spooked a lot of investors on the commercial investment side, is just the fact that the long end of the curve, 10-year, you know, 5 to 10-year, which is, you know, what real estate generally looks at, has been persistently trying to get back up to 4%, which begs the question, okay, what's my borrowing cost then? Then what's my cap rate? And, you know, you could see a short end come down and a long end that starts to come up because, you know, those that took economics at university know that an upward, a flat yield curve means there's probably going to be very little GDP growth, if any, and an upward sloping means we should see economic growth. Well, if the short end's at 3 and the long end's at 4, like that's pretty normal in every other time.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, I think you'll continue to see this sort of tale of two types of investments and asset classes being, you know, commercial versus residential. I mean, residential is taking it on the chin right now. Developers are having, you know, taking it on the chin. They own land. It's that floating debt. It's hard to carry. There's no income to be able to support the interest payments. And so I think, you know, like the short end, I think residential is totally exposed to the short end. And we'll see how sort of that evolves. And as for our investment thesis, we always have the same investment thesis. Our growth fund is trying to double its equity, earn a 20% IRR. I might tweak the assumptions about, you know, what we think we might be able to buy something for and sell something for and collect cash flow along the way. But I'm financing it on the basis that I'm getting whatever financing is available today in the market, and I'm making investments on that basis. And there's a value add play and a way to, you know, invest the capital, and you have a thesis and you execute the strategy. If you have a strategy and you execute it, and it doesn't matter what the market necessarily is doing or what the interest rate is necessarily doing, you lock in as much of those things as you can. And then you make a call and you make an investment. And that's the same investment thesis that we've had through every crisis and throughout the entire time at KingSett that we've been investing capital. In terms of uncertainty, I would say the best thing that you can do is just try to mitigate risk. I mean, that's number one, what we're always trying to figure out how to do. How do we mitigate risk? Are there ways that when we do a joint venture that we can, you know, maybe get our equity back first before, you know, our partner? Maybe some of our return is preferred, you know, to theirs, so that you're trying to mitigate downside risk all the time. And so we're always thinking about different ways to do that. But outside of that, I think the thesis is to try and find opportunities to invest into good quality real estate, have a thesis, stick to it. And, you know, when you're done, sell. Market might be up, might be down, but chances are you'll make money if you stick to the thesis.
Going back to the, you know, not much distress, you know, so far, do you think, you know, in that has to do with the recourse? Like in the US, it's non-recourse and it's
totally,
you know, and it's not personal, you know, so Brookfield can hand the keys back, you know, to the bank, and they'll sell it for 50 cents to Blackstone, and then Blackstone will throw the keys back on one of theirs and they'll sell it for 50 cents to Brookfield, and they both go, well, Fund 6 is going to be a disaster, but Fund 7 is going to hit it out of the park. And whereas here, you know, if you cross one of the banks, it's a small town, you're out of business forever.
Yeah, that's right.
So there is, do you think that's responsible for the, you know, the fact that there's been sort of no change in pricing, you know, on the commercial side?
Yeah, for sure. That's a big factor. And also just leverage, you know, lending levels, both how our banks underwrite things. You know, they're very stringent, they're OSFI regulated. You know, versus, and then the borrower doesn't borrow as much money in Canada. So, you know, it's those types of factors. That being said, prices have backed up. I mean, there are appraisals that are backing up. There are transactions that are happening that are, you know, people are wrapping their heads around that are definitely at higher cap rates than 2 years ago or 3 years ago. But for sure, the distress side of it, yeah, absolutely. I mean, the lending community, I mean, most of the borrowers in Canada are recourse. Almost all of them are recourse. Even if you're not recourse, it's such a small market that, like, if you throw back the keys, you know, that's probably one of the first questions any lender would ask you is like, well, I remember when you threw back the keys. You know, like, it's just too tight.
27 years ago.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Are you kidding? Like, that's... people remember all the way back to the 90s, put it that way. So,
yeah, that is funny. I mean, I've been kind of shocked at that there hasn't been more distressed land sales, just because I, you know, follow, you know, land prices pretty closely, especially on the high density side. And things just got out of control there in 2009. And then again, really, even in COVID, we had some really high land prices on a per buildable square foot basis, and there just hasn't seemed to be as many deals flopping, or, you know, there's been a few high profile projects that have stopped construction, but not as many as I would have anticipated given the stress in the market. But I'm not sure there was a question there, but
it seems that, you know, there's either the, you know, I know families that have owned the land forever and they say, well, only have to sell once, you know, now doesn't have to be the time, I can put it away for another 10 years or else, you know, there are the people that borrowed and have a land loan and thought they were going to replace their land loan with a construction loan based on their pre-sales and the pre-sales didn't go well. And now they're going back to the bank saying, hey, can we keep doing this for longer? Yeah. You know, that's where you're going to have.
Yeah. And there are some of those out there. I mean, there are court appointed sales going on right now. Projects that are, you know, not that are midway through construction that are being sold, and they're trading, and they are trading. And you know, in most instances, the equity is wiped out, and the you know, the lender's made whole. So it is a great observation. There is still lots of land. There are projects that aren't moving forward. And are we going to start to see more court-appointed receivership sales of residential land? And, you know, time will tell. You can wait a year, you can wait 2 years. I mean, it is, you know, a bit of a ticking clock in the sense that you do have an interest cost and no ability to carry it, right? Yeah. There's no income-producing aspect of that investment. So that's a great question. And I would say that the one thing that Canada continues to have going for it is a good place to live, despite all the complaining we always do, certainly from what I've seen on LinkedIn. And relative to the rest of the world, and continues to have a ton of immigration. I know that there will be a spotlight on that a lot in, you know, these next elections in the next few years, because we've been debating whether or not we have the right immigration plan. But there's still a lot of immigration, and like having that much population growth, you need more of everything. You always need more of everything. So, you know, I think those tailwinds are hard to ignore when you think about the housing supply and you think about land that's, you know, zoned for housing. You know, I would, it's hard for me to bet against that, put it that way.
Yeah.
I mean, to, I guess, feeds in a little bit with the immigration, you know, point, but ultimately if there's a pause, you know, and then there's all this pent up demand, and then, you know, there's right. The, you know, short rates go down a little bit and the starting gun goes off and everybody wants to buy, isn't construction the, you know, the constraint? Like there's only so many projects that can get through that part of the process.
Now, construction has come off quite a bit. I mean, there are a lot less cranes in Toronto than there were before. And you are having now more opportunity on the development side to, you know, get more than one quote from a trade. And they return your call. And maybe they were looking at a job or thought they had a job and now they don't. So they're, you know, they're available. I mean, good developers know how to work those relationships and bring prices down, quite frankly. You're seeing that happen. The flip side is labor costs are up everywhere, right? I mean, there's wage growth happening everywhere in our economy.
Trade price is there.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
Those increases are way down.
It's hard for them to go the other way, because you're not going to suddenly start telling people they're going to earn less.
My worry is that if things get so bad on the starts front that we start losing people out of the construction business, right? Which just at the time when we need more people to help get projects built. So, yeah. I don't know. I haven't looked at the StatsCan numbers. Not that I trust them at all, to be honest with you. Yeah. No offense to any of the StatsCan people that might be listening to this show.
There you go. Yeah.
Robert, do you have another question?
We've seen some of the stories, you know, in the media about, you know, single family home, you know, sales where people have sort of showed up and can't get the financing to close on, you know, the deal. In the 90s, that actually happened in, you know, condo land as well. Mm-hmm. Are you seeing any of that, or does the inventory loan kind of paper that over?
And only anecdotally. I mean, I haven't seen it. We haven't closed on anything where. You know, somebody was showing up at closing and saying that I'm having a hard time arranging financing. I mean, you hear about it. Is that what you mean? Mm-hmm. Yeah. Where in some projects, Vancouver in particular, where, you know, it was a high end, more of a luxury condo project that Westbank actually completed and had a hard time actually getting the closings done. And there was some restructuring or some lending that was, you know, happened that was required, some buying down of interest rates, things like that, or people not qualifying and so needing, you know, a higher equity check than they thought. I mean, I hear anecdotes about that happening. I haven't actually seen it happen. But I imagine, you know, that will probably persist.
Interesting. I had a question about a couple of your projects here. You've bet big on, you know, transit friendly locations, as you mentioned. You bought sites in Bloor that, you know, hadn't previously experienced, you know, development activity like, you know, Dovercourt and Lansdowne. You recently completed an assembly in the Weston area, you know, a part of the city that developers would not have touched with a 10-foot pole maybe 15 years ago. But, you know, despite all the acquisitions and activity in that area, doesn't seem that anyone's moved yet. What do you think is the holdback in the Weston area? Maybe these sites haven't got to approvals yet. What do you think is going to be the impetus to get things moving there?
I think transit had a lot to do with it. The transit, you know, the UP going through there was a big part of that, the UP Express. And that station is only just being completed now. The Weston station's only just opening now. So like all of our grand transit plans, they definitely took longer to build. And there are projects that have gone ahead. There are pre-sales that have gone ahead, you know, especially at Lawrence and Western Road, which is, I think, our Western Road site, which is right beside the station, will be a great site. And zoning has been a little bit slower there for us because we, you know, assembling the land took a little bit longer. And there was an aspect of whether or not we wanted to make it bigger or work with what we had, or, you know, there's a little bit of that. You know, that's an urban infill fund. So the urban infill fund was looking for opportunities like that, intensification, assembling sites. And the urban infill fund didn't use financing. So that was, in hindsight, a good strategy.
Wow.
But, and so it had the luxury of time. And, you know, really the thesis there was you wanted to wake up one day and realize that, like, you owned, you know, a number of acres on Yonge Street south of Bloor, which were all great sites and in the path of intensification. And then think through, are there other places around the city where, you know, that might also be the case. The Yonge Street strategy, I think, still is by far and away the best strategy in terms of people even today saying that they want to be on transit near, you know, the core, near Union, near, you know, basically in the action. I find that, and it's younger people that are probably driving that narrative, but that's a pretty big demographic. So the thesis has worked really well on our land holdings, you know, up and down Yonge Street and in Yorkville. And then, you know, the other ideas like Western Road, you know, that's probably more of an affordable play. Could be something that we do with our affordable fund one day. That could be really, you know, a really interesting on transit affordable project. That could be a great outcome for that. Or maybe the market picks up a little bit more. You know, the land cost is obviously considerably lower than it would be on Yonge Street, you know, south of Bloor. So, you know, your pro forma would be a little bit different. Your tower height wouldn't be as high. The construction costs, you know, would be a little bit less. So it might be, you know, an opportunity for the right developer who's looking for more of that development strategy versus building something in, you know, urban Toronto.
So when you look back on the, I know the golden age of rental development in Toronto was
when
kind
was
of
that?
Like the 60s and 70s, like all the you know, tower in the park, you know,
yes.
Kind of thing. So all the Yonge and Eglinton, you know, Yonge Corridor, Bloor West, all on transit, oddly enough. But I, you know, when I've talked to guys that were around then, and it's like the numbers didn't make sense then either. The only thing that tipped the scale was the government came in with legit programs, whether it was the MERB program or it was other dedicated programs. Like, other than CMHC sort of trying to put their hand on the scale a little bit, like, are you seeing any you know, evidence of, you know, programs that are going to, you know, that happen?
Yeah, I mean, the HST announcement was huge. That was a big incentive. That had a big impact on, you know, right to the bottom line of the pro forma. The CMHC programs certainly are, I think, are working. I think there'll be more. I mean, it's such a topic of discussion amongst all levels of government right now, right? And they'll continue to do things.
Was there a new tax sheltering program within the latest budget? Did I read that correctly?
The inclusion rate went up. I don't know what you mean about the sheltering part. That part I remember. No, I don't. I think there were some other things, but I, you know, as always with a budget, they're always hard to unpack or exactly know what they mean because they haven't been adopted yet or put into practice. But no, it's, you know, the budget, at least it does identify the fact that, you know, those programs are needed. And so I think we'll continue to see them. I mean, the municipalities in some instances are looking at all sorts of different things, whether it's development charge credits or maybe some tax deferral. I mean, there's all sorts of things that are happening. You got to start by asking. I mean, the development community does have to ask and see if there's a way that they can get some of these things done. If it's not a formalized process or solution that, you know, whatever level of government is proposing. But it is a good time to ask, because everyone's aligned in the sense that all levels of government are all trying to build housing and affordable housing. So we're able to find ways to build out, you know, our Valhalla project, you know, which I mentioned earlier that we're building, which is on the 427. It's about 400 units. A third of them are affordable, what we call sort of workforce housing. So, you know, your rent there would be probably around $1,500 a month, that type of thing for one bedroom. So not
deeply affordable, but affordable in relation to
bucks
the market.
A month, but yeah, like $1,500 a month. I mean, you can't find an apartment building for $1,500 a month anywhere. Yeah. Right, especially not in a new building, and it's nice and everything. So, and then there are programs that we're partner with not-for-profits, and they obviously supplement some of the rents, and those are more in the $700-$800 a month, you know, for those in need, for those types of people in need. So there's enough, you know, we're trying. I think there's lots of others that are trying to be able to provide that product. It's a ton of work to try and figure out what the program is or the incentive is that the CMHC or the government's trying to do. And, you know, it's lots of sort of hoops and things to jump through. The CMHC process has been very drawn out. Mainly they've been inundated with applications from regular CMHC financing to, you know, the different types of programs that they roll out, and they acknowledge that they're trying to get it all done, but it's just taking time. So unfortunately, time is the developer's enemy right now. And so if it takes you 7 months or whatever to figure out what your financing looks like, that's already too long. And everybody's doing the best they can. I truly believe that. So, you know, you really got to dig, and you got to push, and you got to, you know, suggest those types of ideas to all levels of government.
Yeah.
And their hand has to be on the scale, because they have to be offering something in order to limit it to a quote affordable, because otherwise your obligation to your investors is, if you can get $7 a square foot for rent, that's what you're going to, you know, that's what you're going to get. You know, it's so.
Yeah, or otherwise, you know, you won't build at a loss. You can't build at a loss.
Right. So they've got to say, fine, we will do something to reduce your, you know, your cost burden, and in return, you know, it's you know, you have to deliver these units at, you know, the affordable price. Then at least it's can still calculate the math, but you know,
feds will give you some money, and then the city of Toronto will raise your development charges by 20%. So,
but at the end of the day, you know, teachers and, you know, it's not just, you know, deeply affordable, it's teachers
totally
and
agree.
Firemen. And,
yes,
you know, they used to have, you know, employers, you know, the hospitals on University Avenue used to have staff accommodation. They don't have that anymore. They sold it to greedy real estate developers. You know, so, but, you know,
there
the people still got to live somewhere.
I don't know any really greedy real estate developers.
I honestly think in the future that businesses will have an office building, and part of that office building, they will have a bunch of units for their first-time employees. Right? That someone's graduating, they can't even afford to live in the city of Toronto. But for the first year, you can live in the Kingstead Apartments on the second floor above the muffin shop, right? Because that's, and then you can come up and live here, and that's part of your incentive package, right? I think that may be the future of our market, is businesses actually having to provide housing for some of their employees.
Well, there used to be a hotel at the top of Scotia Plaza. You could bring that back.
I mean, you raise a good point. We've always had, there's probably always been a sense that cities like Toronto are unaffordable to live in, and yet people figure out a way to live in them. You know, it's a balance for sure. The average person is pushing back on rent, and they should. I mean, it's hard to make ends meet right now with inflation, with everything going on in the world. It's hard. And, you know, in some instances, I applaud the way that the programs are responding and the government programs are responding, because there are solutions that are being provided that provide affordability. it's the execution of it that, you know, is always hard to articulate if it's the right way to make that happen. And I'm of the view and opinion that everybody is at least trying to do the best they can, and we just got to keep banging away at it, and hopefully, you know, the better minds and hearts will prevail, and we'll get back to, I think, a city that, you know, right now is going through some challenges, all sorts of social and issues, and I got to believe that we're going to get back to a better environment for everybody, including affordability. Put it that way.
So before we move on to, we have one last section called the rapid fire, but I did have one last question for you. And I just wanted to read an announcement that you guys had on your website. It says, Kingset's Affordable Housing Fund is pleased to announce this joint venture at 705 Warden Avenue in Scarborough with our partner Greenwind. Located on Warden Subway Station, this rental project will have 250 affordable units in addition to 325 market units. So I don't live too far, obviously, from there. I don't live too far from my office here. But the one thing I noticed is like the maximum height is 19 stories. You know, I think this is kind of criminal, right? That there should be three towers of 35 to 40 stories on that, you know, really twice as many units when you'd end up getting a lot more affordable units. Why do you think the city continues to underzone these like sites that they're putting out for affordable housing?
So I don't know the full history on that. The city might be putting the land in that deal too. So it might, that might, you know, that's a little bit of a different instance. And if that's the case, then all you're doing by building higher really is bringing down your average land cost.
Yeah.
Building higher is also more expensive. You need more elevators, you need more structure. There is a sweet spot, you know, when you're developing. I think one of the reasons why the narrative has always been like, let's build as tall as we typically can, is because the land is so expensive, especially in downtown Toronto. As you move further out, I'm not sure you need to build towers to the sky. So I don't mind that. I think any developer would probably prefer to not build, you know, towers to the sky. You know, as you look out the window and you look at all the land and the low rise land around, I mean, there's lots of land. So I don't know. I think taller isn't always better. It is if you're maybe in Yorkville and you're trying to, and you have nothing but tall towers around you to begin with.
Yeah.
But you know, I get that you're also trying to create a community. You know, Valencia is a good example in Spain where every single building is six stories. But it's like the whole city is six stories.
Yeah.
It's not taller than that. And it's not shorter than that.
Yeah.
And there's parks everywhere and there's nice quality of life. I don't mind that. I don't think that the solution is just build tall towers to the sky everywhere. Where I struggle with it is in sometimes when you're right on transit and you're in a dense neighborhood already and you're trying to pay for transit and then you're limiting density. I mean, like things like that, I think, you know, aggravate me sometimes. When you're building affordable, you got to remember too, like tall towers are expensive and you're really trying to find the best, you know, intersection between cost mitigating, you know, like cost creep, and you're trying to be as efficient as possible when you're developing that tower, because you're trying to build, you know, to a much lower price per foot than you typically, you know, are able to, because you just don't have the revenue to support it. So
I would think the marginal cost of each additional floor is lower. And if you have a repeatable floor plan for 30 stories, then it should be more efficient than building a shorter, fatter 19-story tower.
There's a balance, right? So, yeah. There's a, you know, there's like you get over a certain height, you need another elevator. You get over a certain height, you need different seismic requirements, different, you know, different structure. It's a balance.
Yeah.
It is a balance.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Well, we have one last section in our show, and Robert, I redid some of these questions, so you might have to read them off our phone. So really this section is, we hit you with really quick questions that we're looking for like 5 to 10 word answers to. Could be a yes, could be a no, could be a pass. Most of them are real estate related, but occasionally we throw a little loop in there. So, all right. Oh, so okay. I'll do them all in. All right. Are you ready?
Yeah. Ready.
Okay. In your opinion, is missing middle housing a viable investment in Toronto?
I have no idea. It's the missing middle housing. What is the missing middle housing?
Middle is really bigger than a single family home, but smaller than a six story mid rise.
The fourplexes you can build in every neighborhood now. Well, you can't build them, but you're allowed to.
I don't know if it's. Do you think that's missing? That's what people say are missing.
Yeah, it's called. Is that like a laneway home? Yeah, it would be a laneway home. It would be a three-story townhome. It would be a fourplex, a sixplex, stuff like that. A lot of people are trying to build those, but there's a lot of pushback in the low-rise neighborhoods against. You know, even Doug Ford called them four-story towers, even though they're fourplexes.
I don't know if I have an opinion. I don't know. I mean. Yeah, this is a terrible start to the rapid fire because I totally blew it. All right, we'll move on then.
So yeah, that's a good question. Should developers sue buyers that don't close on their units?
I think people should stick to their contracts, put it that way.
All right, that's a good answer, good answer. Are there any new names in Toronto real estate that we should watch out for? Someone that you met that you're super impressed with? Anyone pop into your mind?
That are new?
Yeah, maybe new. Maybe someone doesn't know about, or someone that's on their first or second project that you're just, you know, wow. You're like, wow, this guy's a smart dude or smart guy.
Well, I think there's a ton of smart people in real estate. Are they new? I haven't seen anybody recently. I think everybody's probably working through the challenges of the current environment, and that's probably more top of mind right now than new entrants. Gotcha. Probably hard to enter the market right now. Yeah, I would guess.
Exactly. I'm going to do a future podcast with a round table of quote unquote new developers, and we'll see how that goes.
So, I'd love to know if there are new developers out there right now.
Because
I'll tell you,
there are people starting companies, but they typically, you know, had 10 to 15 years at another development company and have some equity behind them. All right.
So far, I'm one for three. Anyway, let's keep going.
Will the new changes to the capital gains tax negatively impact housing investment?
Should have a negative impact, I would guess.
Yeah. Who would you rather have lunch with to discuss the housing crisis? Justin Trudeau, Doug Ford, or Olivia Chow?
I'd pick Olivia Chow. I'd put Justin Trudeau at the back of the bus because I don't really want to talk to him. But Olivia Chow, you know, who would probably have a vastly different viewpoint than me.
Yeah.
And I think that could be an interesting lunch.
Yeah. You can talk about Sherborne with her. I'm sure she'll be happy to talk about that one with you.
Yeah. There you go.
If the residential market remains soft into 2025, do you think more developers would just stop paying their land loans? Kind of discuss that a little bit.
I think there's risk, but we'll see as that unfolds, put it that way.
Live up to their contracts.
So we can do the same response.
That's true.
Many American hedge funds have tried to short the Canadian housing market for years. Will they actually make money on that bet this year?
You know, I don't know what the cost is of that short. It's got to be expensive.
I'd imagine so. I don't know. I'm not sure what they're shorting. The banks, they tried with Home Capital, so I'm not sure.
I haven't seen housing prices come down anywhere like really in Toronto.
Yeah.
Other than maybe in the condo market to some extent. But like so far that bet hasn't paid off. I don't know if it will.
Should pre-construction condo investors buy units with projected negative cash flow at completion?
So that's an investment, a condo investor, right?
Yeah.
As opposed to a user. I probably wouldn't make that bet. I think that'd be sort of tough to do today. I'd probably say no.
If you wore a beige linen suit to work with no socks and loafers, would John Love say something to you about it?
Would John Love say something to me about it? He might crack a joke about it.
or never speak to you again.
No. John would have fun with that, I'm sure. Put it that way. What was it? Beige suit and loafers?
Yeah, loafers and no socks.
Yeah. Man, I couldn't even imagine. Good thing I don't own those.
Last one. Are potential mortgage delinquencies a media topic created to generate clicks? Or will this be a serious issue in Canada when all these renewals come up this year?
In the low-rise residential space. For sure there's going to be a conversation because there will be those who require pay downs or, you know, might have a difficult time refinancing. So, that's for sure something that I got to think that the Fed is watching.
Yeah, interesting. Well, that's all the questions we had for you. If someone wants to get in touch or I'm not sure if they can
invest. We're going to open the phone lines now?
I'm not sure if we can. not sure if the regular Joes can invest in your funds. I think you have to have a big net worth or a pension behind you. But if someone just at least wants to find you on LinkedIn or find KingSett, where do they go to do that?
Reach me, cbarilek@kingsettcapital.com, or just call into the KingSett main line. You can find all of our email addresses on our website. So by all means, I'm always open to a conversation or a new idea.
Nice. Yeah. Nice. Any final words, anytime. Robert?
And KingSett always takes the meeting.
We always take a meeting. Nice. For sure, we always take a meeting.
That's awesome.
There you go.
All right. Thank you.
Thanks a lot. Thanks, guys.